Registration Number 39382, and I represent Michelle Defender. I'd like to focus my argument today on the district court's failure to suppress items seized during the officer's warrant search. But if you have questions regarding the argument concerning the prosecutorial and public employee, then I'd be happy to
Could you speak up a little? Could you speak up a little? Thank you.
Partner with me. One night in late January of 2008, while she was babysitting, Ms. Shepherd Duncan received a phone call from Grand Junction Police Officer He told her that he had responded to a 911 call of a reported assault at her apartment. Ms. Shepherd Duncan stated that she would be home as soon as she could find someone to supervise the children she was then babysitting. When she arrived home, she found Officer Carnes waiting for her in her kitchen. Now, during this phone call to Ms. Shepherd Duncan, Officer Carnes notably did not ask for consent to search. Instead, he waited until he could confront her in person when he was already inside her home before he asked for consent. And that really is the heart of all the constitutional violations that occurred in this case following Officer Carnes' decision to remain in the home after the completion of his protective sweep. The one that I would really like to focus on today is the fact that he did not leave the home prior to attempting to gain consent from Ms. Shepherd. We would argue, of course, that every minute that he spent in the home following completion of the protective sweep was, in fact, a constitutional violation. However, assuming that
Ms. Bullard, I want to jump on that point right there.
Sure.
In particular, the point where the officer goes to retrieve the cell phone. Now, we have a victim of a crime on the scene who says that his cell phone is in the living room. Why is it improper for the officer to retrieve the victim's cell phone?
Upon the completion of his protective sweep, Officer Carnes did not have any authority to remain in the home. But while he was in the kitchen, he called his fellow officer on the cell phone and then attempted to gain consent from Mr. Hicks, who was then in the hospital at the time. Now, given the evidence that was presented at the suppression test hearing, we would argue that there wasn't enough evidence to support the fact that he had either actual or apparent authority to consent, meaning he was not a cohabitant of the home. There was no evidence that he had the capacity to give, allow others to enter the home or to allow others to be there. And so, it was the prosecution's burden to establish that the person that they got consent from, in fact, had authority to give that consent. Because if someone does not have authority to give consent, then of course the consent is invalid. So
but the consent here wasn't a consent for a general search of the premises. It was a very narrow consent to get my phone from the living room.
Right.
So isn't that different qualitatively from the kinds of searches that the Fourth Amendment is concerned about?
I would argue that the fact that it was limited consent is important because, in fact, Mr. Hayes only gave consent for the officer to go into the living room to get his cell phone. And at that point, the officer did not then, after he had obtained the cell phone, go in and go and leave the house at that point. Instead, he remained. And I think that is where a lot of the problems arise because it was while after he had obtained the cell phone and was on the phone conversing with this person, Brandy, that he then saw the contraband. The bomb in the living room. And more importantly, whether or not this court agrees that Mr. Hayes had consent, had the authority to consent to that initial obtaining of the cell phone from the living room, the fact of the matter is that after he had made these phone calls, contacted Ms. Shepherd Duncan, and then hung up the phone, he didn't leave, at least for a little while. He played with her dog, then he left the home to walk the dog, and then he re-entered the home before obtaining consent. And that second re-entry, that re-entry into the home, at that point, he had no justification under the Fourth Amendment to be there, let alone to search or to go hang up a leash or do any other actions. He had no authorization, given Mr. Hayes' limited consent, to be in the home at that time.
Ms. Bullard, what is your position? When did the officer first do anything illegal?
The first violation occurred when he did not leave the home after the completion of the protective sweep. At that point, he did not have the right to stand in the home while he attempted to obtain consent. And so his staying in the kitchen while he attempted to call his fellow officer, who was with the victim in the hospital, was a violation of Ms. Shepherd's rights under the Colorado Constitution.
And what is your legal authority to that point in time that an officer may no longer be on premises after a sweep?
That would be Maryland v. Buie, would be the main case on point. It basically, under Buie and under, I believe it was Bowers in Colorado, basically the holding is that once protective sweep is complete, you must then immediately leave. A number of, for example, Mr. LeFave, who wrote a very learned a treatise on the subject, likewise Ruiz, and points out that once there is no longer an emergency, and once that protective sweep has revealed no one who needs further assistance in the home, there's no justification for remaining, because that's the whole idea behind justification, is that someone then needs your assistance, and that's why we're willing to say at that point, okay, the Fourth Amendment, maybe we're not going to extend its protections in an emergency situation like that. But the moment we determine that an emergency situation no longer exists, then any justification behind allowing a protective sweep evaporates, basically. And at that point, you must leave.
Well, Ms. Bullard, at that point, though, he remains in the kitchen. And as I understand the record, none of the incriminating evidence was found in the kitchen.
In this particular case.
In this particular case, okay.
The evidence relating to the other crime with which, of course, Ms. Shepherd Duncan was not involved was the knife.
So even if we characterize remaining as in the kitchen as some kind of a search, that particular search did not reveal any of the evidence that was the subject of the motion to suppress. What we have here is subsequently a consent to search by the defendant. So what evidence is there in the record that ties the earlier illegality, the staying in the kitchen, with her consent? What evidence is there that her consent is influenced by that?
I would say that the officer's presence in the home, not necessarily in the kitchen, but his staying in the living room after he had completed the phone call, we have a number of things. He stays in the kitchen, then he goes into the living room. Going into the living room, we would argue, was unjustified because there was no authority for Mr. Hastings' consent. Assuming even there was arguendo that there was authority for Mr. Hastings' consent to search the living room for the cell phone, remaining in the living room after he had obtained that cell phone is yet another Fourth Amendment violation because Mr. Hayes' consent was limited only to obtaining the cell phone, not to remaining in the house and not to doing anything further in the house. After that, probably the fourth violation would be the fact that the officer then remained in, after he had completed the phone call to Ms. Shepherd Duncan, he remained in the home waiting for her. He remained in the home for a bit, walked the dog, then came back. And at that point, there is no justification. So we have an unlawful re-entry into the home following walking the dog. And at that point, there is no justification. And therefore, when he is inside the home, his illegal presence is not distinguishable, not attenuated. Immediately after he leaves that home, following his presence in her kitchen, she enters the kitchen. It is the fact that unlawful presence in her kitchen then helps to elicit her consent that is the problem here, because we have no separation between the illegality, which is his presence in the kitchen, and her subsequent consent.
What is the evidence on the point as to whether the officer informed Ms. Shepherd Duncan during the telephone call that he was in her residence? Is there any evidence on that point?
There's no evidence in the record that he communicated that he was going to be in her house or waiting for her inside her house. So based on the record before us, what we know is that Ms. Shepherd enters the home and discovers him there. And at that point, it is comparable to someone who has eaten half your cupcake, has crumbs on his chin, and is asking you, can I eat this cupcake? He is basically already violating her rights and asserting his authority to be in her home while he asks her, can I be in your home? Can I search your home? And this, to me, under those circumstances where you have a woman who has been informed that there has been an attack at her house, she doesn't know if there is a chance that she might be somehow suspected of being involved. She doesn't know that someone might be lurking in her home. She doesn't know if the officer has already searched. All she knows is this officer is already in her home, and yet he's asking her for consent nevertheless. And under those circumstances, you would argue that those are coercive circumstances, and that there really isn't a way to obtain a voluntary contain or one that is somehow attenuated from the unlawful illegality.
Well, let's switch gears a little bit. I sensed from your briefs that your position is the officer's intent in searching the residence was not to obtain evidence relating to the stabbing, but to obtain evidence incriminating the defendant. Is that Do I understand the briefs correctly? Because I got kind of a sense of that.
Well, the officer's subjective intent as to what he wanted to obtain versus what his purpose being there is a little bit to the side, really. The important fact is that whether or not he was there and meaning to search for items of drug contraband as opposed to evidence of the crime that was committed is kind of neither here nor there when it comes to determining the issue. Because really the issue is, you know, what he didn't do is he didn't tell, when he asked for her consent, this is another important point, he did not convey to her that he had found this other contraband. He basically misled her in the sense that he said, all I want to do right now is search for evidence of the crime that was committed, the assault that was committed. And under those circumstances, in addition to the fact that the officer's already in your home and asking for consent, he doesn't tell you, you know, all the information at that point or the information that's pertinent to whether or not you grant consent. I mean, this is not a case where, for example, you know that you're being investigated for a crime and, or you're suspected of something and you give consent. This is a case where a person's home has been invaded and an officer is saying, hey, can you help me out and I'll help, you know, so that I can find the person who did this to you? And it's not a full disclosure. And when you have deception on that point and you have an officer who remains in the home clearly without any justification, I think we have a very flagrant violation.
How do we know it was a deception? Because had the officer been intent upon discovering evidence that would incriminate the defendant in this case, wouldn't the officer have just gone right to the bong? He knew where it was. He'd seen it. Instead, he apparently disregarded that, at least temporarily, while he searched the rest of the house.
Well, as we will note, he went to the bong first, made note of her observations, left the room. To me, it seems as if he wanted to see what her reaction would be and whether or not she noticed. He specifically asked whether or not she noticed anything new in the house, and that's also seems to be eliciting some kind of an incriminating either response or no response, which seemingly indicating.
Ms. Bullard, one of the things we look at to determine whether the consent was attenuated from what you're saying is the initial illegality is the purpose of the misconduct. And you're saying the misconduct is that the officer remained in the home after the protective sweep. So what was the purpose for the officer remaining in the home?
There seems to be no purpose that I can assume. I mean, it's January and it's cold. there really seems to be no need for the officer to remain in the home. If he wanted to protect the home from being invaded or keep it safe and secure, could have remained outside the home. There's no reason for him to be in the home at that point. He could be outside of the home asking for consent, or he could have asked for consent over the phone. But instead, he chooses to remain in the home in order to obtain her consent, which would seem to imply that perhaps he believed that it would be more, that she would be more apt to consent if she finds him already in her home. That is what I draw from. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Joseph Michaels, attorney registration number 40403. I'm here today on behalf of the people of the state of Colorado. Before I get started, I'd like to thank the faculty, staff, and administrators here at Pine Creek High School for hosting us. This is a very valuable experience. There are a lot of reasons why this suppression was properly denied at the trial court level, and I think I'd like to focus exclusively for the moment anyway on the consent issue. And the crux here is that Deputy Carnes did not search or seize any evidence until after Ms. Shepherd-Duncan had consented. As this court knows, the test for consent...
Wait a second. You said he didn't search or seize any until after the consent?
Yes.
Why wasn't the viewing of the bong from a place that arguably he had no right to be in not a search?
I see your point. And that requires a brief tangent over into the facts, and that's perhaps a better way to have started. Deputy Carnes received this dispatch call that there had been a stabbing in an apartment. He arrived there, and there were several firemen and police officers already there. And when he got there, he saw the victim being taken to the ambulance, and his initial assumption is that the victim is the owner of the house. So when he gets in touch with the victim, to say, I would like to search your premise, I'd like to find evidence. The victim says, I can't do that, but in the progression of getting your consent, use my phone, call the specific person, Brandt. So he wasn't looking for anything at the time that he went to use the victim's phone, except for the victim's phone, which, as Judge Jones pointed out, is a very qualitative difference than doing a broad sweep of the whole house looking for evidence without any sort of consent.
Mr. Michaels, let me ask you something about that. So the officer entered into the living room for the purpose of searching for the victim's phone.
Right.
All right. And so that was for the, why did he want the phone for the purpose of?
He wanted the phone because he was trying to find the homeowner. And that was something that was going to have to happen eventually. They were going to have to find the person who owned the apartment. They were going to have to contact this person to say, hey, look, there's been a stabbing here. There's evidence we need to collect, we need to talk to you, we need to contact you. And that was something in just ordinary police investigative procedures to get in touch with that person who's the homeowner. His initial impression was that victim was the homeowner. When he found out that was incorrect, he made the next logical step of trying to figure out who that person was. The victim said, call Brandy. Brandy can give you consent. The logical assumption is that Brandy is the homeowner, and Brandy then says, I'm not the homeowner. Ms. Shepherd Duncan's the homeowner. Call her. So it's a very fluid situation. It's not broken down as in he's trying to search through this victim's directory. He's told specifically, go to here, go to here. Here's the next person's number. He's not looking for anything besides contacting the homeowner. Does that answer your question?
Right. So then I just want to follow up. So then what was the officer's legal justification for entering the living room?
The legal justification at that point, well, there were several. First, he was attempting to seek consent even before he saw the purple bong in the living room, even before he was even thinking about searching the apartment for anything specific, he was looking for a phone to contact the owner. And that's something that a police officer has to be allowed to do to find the homeowner, to get in touch with them in order to say, this something has happened. And that's something that anybody would want. I know if there was a stabbing in my apartment, I would want somebody to get in touch with me, and I would not want somebody else to say, here you go, you can go ahead and consent. Now, the opposing counsel mentioned that the victim was not a cohabitant, had no apparent authority, but the officer didn't know that until he got the phone and was told, I can't give you consent, talk to this person. Does that answer your question?
Well then when you were stating that anyone would want an officer to be able to go do that, are there cases that say an officer can enter into a person's home to find out who the homeowner is?
You know, I looked for some, I'm not sure that they're anywhere, but I'm not sure this court even needs to go there. I think the division of this court's opinion in People versus Benson is entirely dispositive of the entire issue. And in Benson, to refresh this court's memory of it, we had an illegal entry, and there's no discussion here about whether the initial entry was illegal. It was legal. Even the defense conceded that. And so we had the defendant was not present in Benson, just as the defendant was not present here. The defendant was never put in custody, just like in Benson, just like in here. We had the defendant admitting drug use in Benson. We had no reason for the police to initially enter the defendant's residence in Benson. Here we had an initial reason for the defendant, or for the police to enter the defendant's residence. The defendant in Benson was contacted by police, immediately came home, immediately participated in the search, and immediately consented to participate in the search. And this is an important point that I believe Judge Jones, and I think you all as well, Judge Lichtenstein, pointed out, is that the defendant knew that the officers were there. Well, how do we know this? Deputy Carnes contacted her and said, there's been a stabbing in your apartment. He didn't say there was a stabbing outside your apartment or peripheral to your apartment. There was one inside your apartment. The logical conclusion from that is, well, the police had to go in there to find the stabbing person, to get a render assistance to this person. The defendant knew the police were already in there. And what we're talking about here is not why was the police officer still there, but where was the assailant? What we have is a police officer comes to this home, and he sees a broken window. He knows somebody's been stabbed. They don't have the assailant in custody. They don't even know who that assailant is. For all they know, the homeowner could be the assailant. Now, the record here doesn't suggest that, and I'm not suggesting that either. But from the officer's point of view, who's parked out front with the front door locked and the back door was the mode of entry, the only way to protect the house is to stay inside. Did he search when he was inside the house? No. What he did is he found the phone and then went back to the kitchen, where he stayed there, with the brief exception, as has been pointed out repeatedly, to take the dog out to urine.
Mr. Michaels, why was it necessary to remain after the protective sweep, though? At that point, the officer, assuming the protective sweep was done correctly, knows that there are no more victims in the home, and he knows that there are no more, or there's no perpetrator in the home. So why does he have to stay in the home? Why can't he just hang around the back door or around the front door? Not to mention the fact he's not the only officer there, is my understanding. Why does he have to be in the kitchen?
At my understanding, he was the only officer there at that point. I believe everybody else had left with the victim, and one of the reasons I think he had to stay, certainly not at the front door, was because the home was vulnerable. They didn't know who the assailant was. The assailant could have come back. And to the extent that we don't know what the timing was, the trial court hasn't made any real findings of facts on the attenuation issue. And if this court is strongly predisposed towards looking at that, I would suggest it would have to remand it to the trial court to make findings of facts. What the trial court did make findings of facts on, sorry, did that answer your question, Your Honor? What the trial court did make findings of facts on was that when Ms. Shepherd Duncan arrived, Officer Carnes spoke to her very calmly, told her what was happening. She knew the officers were at her home. He didn't arrest her. He didn't put her in custody. What he did is he said, I'd like to search your home for evidence of the crime. That doesn't necessarily mean that he's just looking for a stabbing. There has to be motive. So that's something that they're going to look for. If there are drugs in a home, that might be motive for a break. At this point, anything is on the table. It's not as exclusionary and narrow as the defense is urging. So what we look at is we're looking at from the defendant's objective point of view, and that's there's a stabbing, and the police are here. And he's talking to me in a very conversational tone, letting me know what the situation is. And the findings of fact by the trial court, which this court, as you know, defer to, is that she voluntarily consented. And she did it without being threatened, without being coerced, and without any sort of duplicitous nature from the officer. The second prong is that, as you point out, the exploitation, that there's no prior illegality influencing the consent. And to that effect, as you point out, the only illegal search or entry that could possibly have happened was him staying in the kitchen. He wasn't searching anything outside. All he did was look for the phone, which is to say, and this is something I think that the briefs need a little bit more clarity on, is that he didn't use the bong as the impetus to search. He was looking for the homeowner before he even instigated calling the victim, before he talked to the victim, before he had the victim tell him to contact Randy, who then told him to contact Ms. Shepherd Duncan. He was looking to search, but he wasn't going to do it without consent. He was acting properly, he was acting professionally, and while he might have been a little bumbling about it, this isn't the sort of case where there's going to be a huge deterrent effect in saying, we have to suppress all of this. And that's something that, as you know, the case law is very adamant on, is to deter police misconduct or overreaching. We just don't have that. What we do have is the one thing that could possibly be suppressed, and the only thing we're really arguing about, is this viewing of the bong, which was in plain sight. When the defendant first arrived, she admitted directly to the police officer, I've used methamphetamine. When he asked her if there was anything there, she said, I don't notice anything. That doesn't mean anything. Maybe she didn't see the bong, maybe she did. Maybe she didn't want to draw his attention to it. But when he confronted her about, hey, there was a purple bong here, what happened? She said, I hit it. But then at trial, we don't have any motion to suppress that, which very strongly indicates that this is not a coercive environment. So really, the only thing we're talking about here is suppressing the bong. After that, we still have evidence of the methamphetamines that's found in her bedroom, in the metal box, or in the metal Band-Aid container, and the methamphetamine pipe with the residue inside. No, I think that's pretty much all I wanted to say, except for to see if this court had any further questions for me.
I do have one question.
Sure.
When we take the victim out and the victim says, I've got property inside the house, does an officer have any independent authority under the community caretaking doctrine to go back in and get that property? Or is that a leading question?
That's a leading question, but I'll take it. And I would submit that yes, he does. Because it's the victim's phone, it's his personal property, and he's being taken to the hospital. He wasn't at the hospital, he was literally in the ambulance when Deputy Carnes spoke with him through the other deputy. And so his job was to get the phone and continue his police investigation. In the course of that, pursuing of the community doctrine, the community property, as you say, he saw the bong, which was in plain view. That didn't trigger his interest in searching further. All it did was nothing, exactly, really. He saw the bong, and he moved on. His whole goal in the entire...
You don't think it triggered or raised any interest in searching further by seeing a bong?
Well, I would submit that if an officer ever sees a bong, it would trigger interest. But that wasn't what triggered his interest. That interest was already there based on the stat. There are no further questions from anybody. I would ask that you affirm. And thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
The unlawful search here was precisely the kind of search that the Fourth Amendment was designed to protect against. Above all else, the Fourth Amendment and Article 2, Section 7 of the Colorado Constitution protect our homes. They are our castles, our sanctuaries. We do not want officers to search our homes at will. It was the people's burden at trial or at the district court level during the suppression hearing to establish attenuation between the officer's unlawful presence and search and Ms. Shepherd Duncan's subsequent consent. And they did not do that there. And they should not have second by the affidavit. I believe that the record is sufficient here for this court to make its own taint analysis and determine whether or not Mrs. Shepherd Duncan's consent was voluntary and whether or not it was sufficiently, or whether or not it was derived from the unlawful presence and unlawful searches and how not.
Ms. Bullard, how did the facts of this case materially differ from the facts in Benson?
In Benson, we have an officer on the phone calling the defendant and saying, asking for consent to search. In that case, the defendant said yes. Also, we have the defendant saying, we both know that there's methamphetamine in that home. Here we have a person who is not given consent to search, does not know. At that point, the defendant in that case knew the officers were in the home, and that was established in the testimony and in the evidence. Here we have someone that there's no evidence that she knew the officers were waiting for her in her home, did not give any indication that there were drugs or other incriminating evidence in the home pertaining to her, and so those, I believe, were distinguishments. But moreover, if the community caretaking doctrine allows people to go in, officers to go into the home and then obtain cell phones and walk out, but what else does it allow? Can they go inside and look for suitcases? Can they go inside and look for pots and pans? I mean, what do you really want? What we have here is, I mean, if do we want to live in a society where
we
can remain in our homes and play with our pets and look for evidence against us?
Excuse me, counsel, you're out of time.
I'm sorry. Thank you for your...
Thank you very much. Thank you both, counsel, for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted. Opinion will issue in due course. Court will stand in recess and the bail will so